So Brooks Richards, reel 12.
This idea was pushed also by Fernand Grenier, who was theoretically at least responsible for French Air Force resources in the Committee of National Liberation in Algiers. And it was never a serious starter because it had never been discussed with the Allies, and they certainly hadn't got resources to divert to it. But in a curious way, de Gaulle was prepared not to believe that the Vercors was of great importance to him. And the Germans mounted a really massive operation using parts of three divisions and airborne forces to mop up this resistance area. And, of course, they'd had an airfield within 20 miles of the southern end of the Vercors, Chabeuil, and this was another very important factor. But I think it must have been already in the minds of all Allied staffs that you didn't reckon you could supply airborne forces more than 48 hours ahead of the arrival of land forces. You've got to be absolutely sure, otherwise they get mopped up. Well, I mean, we had this Vercors redoubt manifest itself in spite of no instruction having been given them to come out by a competent inter-allied command. They all entered the field on D-Day Normandy, let's say, a matter of 2 months before the landing in South France took place, and 2.5 months before any Allied troops could conceivably get to them. Well, they were mopped up with considerable loss of life, and those who got away went through a period of great hardship because they had to take refuge up in the on the peaks where there was no water to be had at that season in that limestone area, and if they came down to try and get water, then they were massacred by the Germans. But the Germans landed glider forces at Vassieux on this strip that had been prepared by the engineer with the steamroller for potential arrival of help from Algiers. And it's been a subject of great controversy in France at various points since the war, who was responsible for this cock-up. Interestingly enough, there are books have been written about it. I've never been asked to give any evidence about it. There's never been any implication that the Allies were morally or politically to blame for what happened. And I think it's just. I think it was a situation in which the French really got themselves into, more or less without consultation with us, certainly without adequate consultation, without any arrangement for adequate resources to be made available. Well, this seemed at the time, that's to say about July the 20th, a great disaster, because in terms of morale, the existence of this piece of freed metropolitan France had been a great stimulus. And it had served as a base for a surprising range of raids out into adjacent territory. There was an extraordinary French cavalry officer called Tivoli Guerre. I can't remember which was really his proper patronymic and which was his adopted name, but he, having the arrival of the Germans wrapped his regiment's flag around his body, took to the Maquis in 42 and organized a very effective series of raids on horseback, I mean cavalry raids out of the Vercors against German targets with enormous dash. Of course, he was hopeless getting on with the local frontiers and partisans, but and not very amenable to discipline. But the fall of the Vercors was, as I say, a terrible blow to morale and to poor Francis Kamerz, who had done his best to try and get resources out of us. In the course of that period of the Vercors being held, quite a lot of people were put in from Algiers to take part in the battle, including a lady courier for Francis Kamerz, who had lost his own courier, a very interesting woman called Cicely Lefort, whose house in Brittany had been the beginnings of one of the most successful escape line operations across the Channel to Dartmouth. But she was working herself with Francis in the south, and she was arrested, I think, in Montélimar. And so he needed a courier, and I got from SOE Cairo a most remarkable Polish lady who was the Countess Christina Skarbek, alias Christine Granville. And she had been twice at least into Warsaw during the occupation, across the Balkans and Czechoslovakia, and on one occasion, coming out of Poland, she'd been arrested by Czech Quisling guards, and she bluffed her way out of their hands by waiting till they were crossing a chasm and a bridge across the chasm during the night. She then threw a bag she was carrying into the chasm, and she said, "Now, the only interesting thing you captured tonight was that bag, and you've now lost it. When you get to your headquarters, I'm going to see the most frightful things happen to you for your negligence in not removing it from me." And she so impressed herself. She was a very handsome woman. She'd been Miss Poland 1937 or something like that. She was a skiing champion. She'd been married to the Polish Consul General for the whole of Africa, and was a woman of great presence. That the Czechs let her go, and she got off with another Czech, another Pole, who has always been known as Andrew Kennedy, then and since. And anyway, she was in Cairo and looking round for useful outlet for her talents. And I said I'd be very happy to have her, and I was given complete discretion where to put her in, and she'd made it quite clear she was prepared to cover purposes to become fictively married to somebody. So I thought Francis Kamerz was the obvious person in view of Cicely Lefort's arrest. Put her in to the Vercors, dropped her in, and it was of importance because she subsequently saved the life of Francis Kamerz, as I will recount. Well, the interesting thing is that though it appeared that the resistance had suffered a terrible hammering because of the Vercors setback, which was not the only one it had encountered in southern France, there had been in March a very important action clearing the maquis out of the Plateau des Glières, G-L-I-E-R-E-S, which is up north of Annecy in the Savoie. And the Germans did overrun the maquis, including a last stand made by 30 Red Spaniards commanded by a British SOE officer called, sent from London. I'm not absolutely sure. Hey, I'm not sure. No, I think I'm confusing him with somebody else. But there was a British officer there, and they fought to the last round and were all killed. There was Glier, then there was the Vercors, and there was another area, Barcelonnette, on the Col de l'Arche, the Italian frontier, where it, D-Day, they more or less liberated themselves, and the Germans subsequently overran them and killed another British officer we put in called, he was called Hay, Edgar Hay. Well, in retrospect, it all looks rather different, as I will explain in due course. But at the time, it looked as though resistance had taken a terrible knock on the nose, and the Germans were really more or less on top of them whenever they chose to make an issue of it. But as time went on, late July, we began to notice really that the Germans only moved about in southeastern France in great strength. And before I get involved in that, which leads immediately into the Dragoon landing, Dragoon Anvil landing, I'd just like to say something about one particular man we put in, whom I mentioned before, the man who'd been my first doctor up at Cap Serrat, Henri Rosenchère. Henri Rosenchère, still alive today, was born of Jewish parents in Poland at the beginning of the First World War. His father had already gone to France, seeking to migrate with the whole family there, and was caught by the outbreak of war in France. They'd lived this miserable existence that Jews in the Ukraine and in Poland had suffered of, I think they started originally probably in the Ukraine, where Cossacks used to raid through the villages and beat them all up, and in Poland it was really not much better. So Dad decided that the land of freedom was France. He was going to move there, and he moved off, leaving the family behind. Well, he wasn't seen again till the end of the First World War, when he did succeed in moving the family, Henri and his mother and a deaf-mute brother, to France, where they started life in a very, very miserable way. Father as a furrier, and always the business of helping subsequent migrants coming in, always having them camping in the flat and sleeping in the corridors and one thing and another. And Henri's written a very good book, published only privately in France, about this. He got a first-class French education and was very, very bright. And having no money at all, when he wanted to become a doctor, he had to work half the day, so he worked for Joliot Curie in Joliot Curie's laboratory as a laboratory assistant, and then did all his hospital practical work in the afternoons. But a very clever little man, therefore. And he'd still not written his thesis as a doctor in 1940, or completed his last year of medicine. Called up, and therefore as an NCO, captured in fall of France, 1940, prisoner of war, escaped, captured again, got into the non-occupied zone, bluffed his way onto a troop ship for Algiers, got to Algiers, and got into the resistance there. Made two attempts to get to Gibraltar, joined the Free French, was captured, was let out by the pro-Allied head of the Surveillance du Territoire, Ashiari, the police officer I'd mentioned before. And he was captured yet once again in Tunisia, not actually when he was with me at Cap Serap, but subsequently he was parachuted into eastern Tunisia with a team to blow up a railway, which they blew up. But he was wounded and captured and taken off and found himself prisoner of war for the third time in one war as a British POW at that time. He had some difficulty explaining it. He didn't speak much English, but he seemed to have got away with that. But his main trouble was that he was paralyzed by the bullet in his back. And he had to teach himself, had to get himself better and teach himself to walk again before he could plan to escape. And he made endless escape plans, which were always being foiled by the fact that the camp in which he was had to be moved to a new site because of the Allied advance up Italy. And then when Badoglio threw the sponge in, they finally, he got out of camp and walked down the Apennines, and after spending a couple of months at least with peasants, he was able to cross the lines with two or three other men by digging themselves into a hole in what behind the German lines and waiting for the Germans to fall back across them. So he was in no man's land the following night and able to crawl out and present himself to the first British troops. Came straight back to Algiers, found I was around, and reported duty for me. And I said, Henri, those days are past. You must go and regularize your position with the French authorities now. They took a look at his wound, and they decided he was quite unfit for military service, and were going to invalid him out. And he complained about this greatly, poor fellow, to me. So I said, well, look, we take him as an instructor, Club des Pins, so if you keep him in uniform. So they put him in, they allowed him to go on in the army, came to us as an instructor. And then he came to me one day and he said, you know, I'm really very worried. I foresee that there's going to be a lot of fighting in these maquis, and there are no medical facilities whatever. Very good idea, Henri. What do we do about it? Well, he said, I think we ought to be parachuting medical material in. So I said, marvellous. Go off and see so-and-so, so-and-so, and work out what we need, and we'll get it, and we'll parachute it in. So he worked out a splendid system whereby we put in medical supplies to six main maquis areas with instructions how to use the stuff and so on. And then he came to me and he said, you know, somebody must go round and demonstrate to them how to use it. I said, you know you can't be parachuted on you with your back. Yes, but why shouldn't I go in by sea? Well, eventually I gave way and he was landed by Andrew Croft and went round, was up in Barcelonnette, right close by Hay when Hay was killed. He was in the Vercors as a doctor, looking after, or helping in the hospital in a grotto. And when the Vercors was overrun, we heard very quickly that the Germans had shot the two doctors running this hospital, as well as all the patients in it. So I was morally certain that Henri was dead. And he turned out not to be. In fact, he came back again after the war. He'd been deported. That's later on in the story. But morale was pretty low at the end of July, I was saying, and then we began to notice that the Germans were very much on the defensive in southern France. And finally, early in August, Henri Zeller came out, because we, by that time, were flying aircraft in and out of France quite regularly. Particularly, we had one very good landing ground near Apt, run by Camille Réon, Archiduc, a pre-war barman, young barman, handsome barman from the Côte d'Azur, who was sort of a postman, and who decided to come out of France because he'd started an affair with an Anglo-Irish lady who he thought was going to be interned, so he walked out with her across Spain, came back and reported for duty, and was put back into Provence, where he organized a parachute reception marvelously for the BCRA, and got a DSO for that. He got into trouble after the war too, but at any rate, his landing strip up at Apt was very good, and out on one of these flights came Faisseau, as we knew him at the time, Henri Zeller. And Zeller said, the Germans are absolutely on the defensive. We're intercepting their mail. We know exactly what's going on. They only move about in great strength. And if you're going to land in Provence, once you get through the coastal defences, it's going to be absolutely wide open all the way up to Grenoble. Well, Allied planners were in a very cautious frame of mind at that time, because two Allied beachheads had proved extremely difficult to break out of. First of all, Anzio in Italy. Secondly, the Normandy bridgehead. And they had done their sums for planning purposes for the Provence landing, even when it was decided, on a very conservative basis. They decided it would take them 90 days to get to Grenoble. Well, here we had the senior French military commander of the Force Française de l'Intérieur coming out and telling us this was entirely wrong. Well, he went to see de Gaulle. De Gaulle actually tossed him a copy of the military plan for Dragoon, Anvil, which he read, and he said, this is absolutely potty. Well, of course, once he read this plan, he couldn't in fact be allowed back into France because of the security implications, something de Gaulle hadn't thought of at the time, perhaps. But we decided we must get him to see General Patch, who was going to command the landing in Naples as quickly as possible. So Zeller and I flew via Tunis to Naples and went to see Patch. And we had a long meeting, which I acted as the interpreter. Well, now, it shows how fallible one's own memory is. I remembered of that meeting that Patch hadn't believed what we'd been telling him. And that after the landing, which took place just a week later, when he found that he was breaking out of the beachhead very quickly, he'd had to improvise a mobile striking force very rapidly. And this became Butler Force, which was very important in that particular operation. Now, as a result of research being done by Arthur Funk in the Washington Military Archives, a rather different picture emerges. He's produced, first of all, a text of Zeller's own recollection of that meeting, which Zeller records the young British capitaine, as he thought I was lieutenant commander at the time, but he thought three gallons equals capitaine, and he'd forgotten, I've met him frequently, he'd forgotten it was me, clearly, I've met him many times since. So he didn't name me, but the young capitaine said that I thought he'd won the argument at the end of the meeting. Well, now, I hadn't remembered that I'd ever said that. And Funk has now produced some fairly conclusive evidence that, in fact, Patch started planning from that moment onwards to create a mobile striking force, should this eventuality arise. And he'd hoped to be able to use French troops for this particular purpose. However, de Lattre made it quite clear that he could only have those just for the landing, and he wasn't going to have them taken away from under his immediate command. So he then planned to put together a force out of American resources under General Butler, and after the landing occurred on the 15th of August, and the breakout began about 3 days later, the advance of Butler force began, and it ran almost immediately into Francis Kamerz, who was able to say to Butler, look, the road to Grenoble is absolutely wide open, go right up there any time you want, and why don't you swing artillery round to positions in the Drôme where they can dominate the Rhône Valley. And Butler did this. And the result was that the German army group that was withdrawing from southwestern France up the Rhône Valley under General Blaskowitz came under artillery fire from the hills as well as air attack by American and British fighter aircraft up and down the road. And the bridge at a place called Livron across the Drôme River was blown by the resistance, an operation that SOE had masterminded. And the German engineers couldn't span this rather long bridge with the equipment that they'd got, with the effect that the whole of the withdrawal up the east side of the Rhône came to a halt for about 48 hours. Well, they were absolutely hammered from the air and from the hills. And it was a most extraordinary sight. There were really kilometres of vehicles after the road had been bulldozed free, like that, along both sides, and the place was filled with horses who'd been killed, a lot of horse-drawn vehicles were used in the German army at the time. Anyhow, that Francis Kamerz was there to give this good advice to General Butler was something of a miracle, because he'd been captured some days previously, almost coincidentally with the Allied landing, somewhere near Digne, D-I-G-N-E, I think. He'd had with him, at the time of his capture, another friend of mine, Zan Fielding, who'd been in Crete for SOE with Patrick B. Firmer, who captured General von Kreiper, the German commander in Crete, and got him out as prisoner to North Africa. At any rate, he'd come to Algiers, and we put him in, too. He was captured, Francis was captured, and a French commandant called Sorensen, at a roadblock that they hadn't expected. And they were all in jail. And